manager for the period 2000 to 2004, Danny Wilson. Danny, welcome to the Forever Bristol City podcast. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Very welcome. Thank you. Thanks for asking on.
Okay. Danny, before we talk about your time at Bristol City, you had a pretty distinguished playing and, dare I say, managerial career before you joined us. Let's talk about you as a player. 634 league games, Chesterfield, Brighton, Luton, Sheffield Wednesday and Barnsley amongst them, and 24 caps for Northern Ireland. I mean, how did you get into football? Was it something you thought you were going to do from an early age?
It was always a love of mine. Obviously, my father, he played post-war over in Ireland for Derry City. He was actually chosen to play for Northern Ireland until they actually found out he was English. So he had it in his blood as well. You know, although war at the time was taking precedence, as we know. But after that, you know, he took up part time playing with Derry City. So I had a love for it. I think it obviously rubbed on to me. I was playing it like all kids do, you know, morning, noon, enough, and night time when he got home from school. And from that, you know, it was something that everybody dreamed of, but never thought realistically you'd ever do it. I was training from leaving school. I was training to be an engineer. I went into that side of it. My dad obviously wanted to get something behind it, which is all parents do. And from then on, that's what I was intending to do. And then I was playing for a local side, which is just outside of Wigan. And some scouts came to watch a centre forward who was playing in the same team as myself, a lad called Gary Dickens. And I happened to have a good game on the day, and they asked how old I was, and I was at that time I was still only 16. And it just went on from there. I went to Bury, they were the scouts. I went to Bury and I signed pro with them virtually straight away.
Brilliant. And then your career, as you say, Brighton was probably the first club where you made some inroads there in terms of establishing yourself. I think it was over 100 appearances for Brighton. I mean, any recollections from that time there? Were they, I can't remember what division they were in at that time, but...
They'd just been relegated from the old Premier League, the first division, season I went. They'd just been beaten in the cup final as well, you know, so there was a little bit of a downer for them. But I think from that, no, it was a great club. I mean, the ones prior to that, believe it or not, you've only touched on them, Bury and Chesterfield, in fairness, they're two very good teams. And that was with the start of, for me. I mean, by the time I got to Brighton, I think I played over 200 games. You know, so it was, although I was still quite young, at 23, I think, at Brighton, you know, I got a great deal of experience behind myself. So going down there and playing with the quality of players that were there at the time, Steve Foster's of this world, Jimmy Case, Joe Corrigan, you know, I could reel them off. They were great players. So it was a fantastic experience and a great learning curve from my point of view.
And then you went on to Luton Town, which they were a pretty high-flying side in those days, because I think you actually scored. Was it an equalising goal in, was it the League Cup final you scored for Luton?
It was, yeah. It was against Arsenal, that particular one. We had three or four appearances at Wembley in the short space of time when I was there. It was fantastic times. Again, you know, we were underdogs really because it was a small club, but it was littered with quality players. Ricky Hill, Steve Foster again, Mick Harford, the Steam Brothers. You know, I could go through Mal Donaghy, you know, Les Sealy. They were all internationals, but never really taken seriously, you know, against the big boys, but we always put up a good fight against
them. On that little Kenilworth Road ground, it's a bit like the old Manor ground used to be at Oxford and some of these London grounds. You know, I've seen Luton, when they get going, they can really get going up there, can't they? Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was a tight ground, as you well know. And from that point of view, you know, we had some good footballers and underestimated a little bit, you know, like I said before, and we sprung a few surprises on many occasions.
Yeah, but then the next move where your career really, well, you had some good times there, was the move to Sheffield Wednesday. So a much bigger club with a greater expectation from the fans there. Tell us about your time at Wednesday. And you had a certain Nigel Pearson as a teammate of yours there. So anything you can tell us about Nigel? But Sheffield Wednesday as a club, bigger than anything you've been at before, yes?
Yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, there were a regular 40,000 people in the stadium every week, you know, in the home games. So the expectation level was far above anything else we had been at. Whereas before, you know, we were underdogs and always lucky to win a game. They were expected to it. So it's a different mentality completely. It was a great time. You rightly touched on Nigel. Nigel was my captain for 4 years nearly. Great captain, great leader on the pitch. Fearless, absolutely fantastic. Colossus at the back. Couldn't sort his feet out now and again, like, but there you go. Neither could all of us. Well, he was absolutely brilliant. Great lad as well. Great character, yeah.
Yeah, and he suffered a broken leg, which cost him a place in the two cup finals that you appeared in that year, yeah?
Yeah, we were gutted for him as well. You know, he's he was like ever-present when Nigel was fit. You know, he was first on the team sheet, I'm sure. That Big Ron would tell you that, Ron Atkinson, Trevor Francis, whoever it may be, we were the managers. So when you're missing somebody like that, you do take... You know, there's a big gap to fill. Fortunately, we got away with it. Could we have got away with it on a long-term basis? I'm not too sure we could have done. But, you know, there's one or two players in the club who filled the gap very well.
Yeah. So next on, it was staying up north, and it was a move to Barnsley. And you went there with your teammate, Viv Anderson. So you were his... assistant manager, and he was player manager. That's right, and that's what happened. That was back in 93, wasn't it, yeah?
Well, it was, yeah, and we were approached, or Viv was approached by John Dennis, the chairman at Bristol, Barnes at the time, and he just said, would you come? And so Viv had a word with me. He said, I'll only go if you come with me as my assistant. And I'd just been offered a new contract at Sheffield Wednesday. I was feeling great. I felt fit and, you know, full of enthusiasm. So It was a tough shout, but I thought, well, you know, it may never come again, this opportunity. So I went along with Viv, but Viv was always very open and honest with me that if anything ever came up from another club with Brian Robson, you know, we'd go with Brian. And Middlesbrough came up.
And that's when they made you player manager in 94, yeah? So that was within one season. So stepping up from being a player up to manager with no real training, that must have been, you know, a privilege for you to do it. I mean, getting to manager at 34, a little bit like Lee Johnson, who, as you know, obviously had his time at City, but player manager at 34. How did you get the guidance and the mentoring in terms of how to manage players of whom you've been a part up to that point in time? Or did you just do it on the hoof like a lot of people do in real life?
Well, there was a tinge of that, yeah, of course there was. You know, nobody tells you what to expect when you're being a manager. You know, you just play games every week as a normal player. You know, you finish training, you go home. You know, management is completely the opposite. You're there, you know, 24/7 if you possibly at times. And but I had a great mentor in a coach called Eric Winstanley, who was a former player, and he was one of the coaches of the club when I arrived. Frank Barlow, who I always had a great respect for when he was at Sheffield Wednesday.
I was going to ask about Frank, but we'll come on to him later. But he was there as well then, yeah?
Yeah, and he was at Chesterfield when I was there. So I knew Frank very well. So between the pair of them, you know, over a period of time from asking Frank, you know, certain questions, working with Eric in particular, it was fantastic. So they were massive helps from...
And the expectation of Barnsley, because most people say it's a little town up north, player manager at 94, 95, 95, 96, sort of consolidation. But then, you know, the highlight, I guess, of your career, and at a relatively young age, getting promoted to the Premier League. I mean, that was exceeding their expectations. But I mean, when did you... You know, were you always gearing up for the Premier League, or was it just that you got a good bunch of lads? Because this is something you achieved with Barnsley back then, and football was different, even though it's 20-odd years ago. But, you know, the expectation of Barnsley would obviously be to try and get promoted, but probably, by and large, just being happy in what is the Championship. But did you sort of feel at the start of that season that this is going to be our year, because the previous 2 years you've been building up to it? What was that holy grail that took Barnsley all the way that season?
Well, I suppose you've got to look back and you get, you know, your recruitment, right? We had some great young players, unknown players who we were aware of, that we thought we might get a chance. Wasn't going to cost us a lot of money either, which we didn't have anyway. So we managed to gel those together. But the first game of the season was one that perhaps we opened our eyes a little bit more than we expected, because we went to West Brom and beat West Brom, I think it was 2-3 at the Hawthorns. And they had a fairly experienced side at the time, and we absolutely played them off the park. And we turned to each other, Eric and I, and just said, wow, you know, this... what's going on here? If we can continue with this whole season, we've got a great chance. We never said anything to anybody. We kept it quiet. You know, after one game, you can't go getting carried away. But it filled us with a lot of confidence from day one. And from that as well, the players gave the confidence as well, which you always try to instill in them.
Yeah, because you didn't have any big names in that side either, did you, really? I did have a skip back through.
Well, we didn't, not till later on. I think, you know, the John Hendry and Paul Wilkinson, who came from Middlesbrough, got promotion. They helped us with our final push. But like Neil Redfern, who was quite experienced, but in the lower leagues. I mean, he scored 28 goals from midfield that season. It was absolutely unbelievable return. You know, so, but the rest of them, no, they were just waves and strays, so to speak. And but very, very happy to be in a team that was performing very well.
Well, you got there. You got to the Premier League. Quarterfinals, you got the quarterfinals of the FA Cup as well, because you beat Man United on the way. Any particular highlights? I mean, was it you were up and you didn't have the financial resources to maybe kick on, because it was a one season stay, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, it was, and I think, you know, there's a lot of factors, you know, looking at that, and there's a way of looking at how you go. Do you spend your money that the Premier League give you at the beginning of the season on players, or Do you go for the infrastructure? Do you go for the, you know, do you save the money for a rainy day? You know, the board and our chairman, John Dennis, was brilliant. They put it in the infrastructure of the club, which entailed putting a new training ground and new facilities, because it was quite run down. You know, the training ground was left a lot to be desired at times. So they put a lot of money into that. And what was left, we were able to use for the players, but it was never going to be enough. Even if we had the full quarter of money, it wouldn't have been enough anyway, you know. But you know, we thought, well, let's have a go for it. You know, you never know. It doesn't have to cost you a lot of money at times. We've seen clubs survive on small budgets, and we're still seeing that now in the likes of Burnley. You know how they managed to keep in that Premier League for so long is absolutely fantastic from their point of view, and certainly from Sean Dyche's point of view. So it can be done. But we weren't in that position. We never had that strength, really, and the money at the time to strengthen the team strong enough to be able to.
Well, you came back down, and this day and age, you know, even though you got them up, you might have been binned off, which is what managers seem to do. They have very short memories, Chairman. But you stayed with them. But then Sheffield Wednesday came knocking at the door for you to. Go and join them, because you've proven that you could get a side there. You made a fist of it in the Premier League as well. What was the attraction of Sheffield Wednesday? Was it former club and bigger club?
It was a former club, I think. I mean, bearing in mind it's only 20 minutes down the road from Barnsley, so it was there was a big rivalry there anyway. But when they came calling, you know, you don't get the opportunity sometimes to go to a club of that magnitude. I knew the club inside out. I knew the board of directors to a certain degree. I knew some of the players there, not all of them, but I thought, well, you only live once, you know, you've got to give it a shine of no regrets, and that's what I did.
Yeah, and you went there, and it was a stay of about 20 months, one and two thirds of a season, and there was, at the time, there was sort of like you had the MPs up in arms about it, because Sheffield Wednesday weren't doing as well as expected. I doubt if any of those guys are on your Christmas card list, but if you had your time at Sheffield, could you have done anything differently, or was it just, you know, there were endemic problems that, you know, you couldn't change what needed to be changed, or they didn't have the money to change things that needed to be changed?
Well, listen, I think we can all look back and look at mistakes. There's not a manager that goes through this, through the world of football, that's not made mistakes. I certainly did there. I wouldn't say they were catastrophic ones. They were ones, small mistakes that you would never do again. Yeah. But overall, I think if you speak to the ex-chairman there, and you speak to the people that were on the board at the time, they didn't come up with the support that they should have done at the time, which they promised me. And in doing so, selling players was not on the agenda, but that's what happened. So it was really, you know, from going into the door expecting this and in reality not getting anything but having less as a matter of fact. Yeah. And so that made it very difficult. The first season, you know, we did okay. We managed to stay up. Second season was just a real, real fight. And that was what disappointed me more than anything, that my time at Sheffield Wednesday, because it was a great club. But that let me down. I felt really unsupported at that time, particularly when they knew what was going on, and some of the board members who were the MPs were coming out and saying this, that, and the other. It was astonishing, really, because at the time, you know, the government were trying to get people in jobs, and there was four MPs trying to get me out of it. It was ironic, really. But the furore that followed that was great. I just kept quiet. I didn't say anything. I just let them, you know, burn their own bridges, really, and it died down. They had the conversations with the hierarchy in the parliament, and they told them that enough was enough, and they had to stop doing what they were doing. So it didn't make my job any easier, because we still had a tough time to go. But what happened was, you know, the Sheffield Wednesday fans in particular, you know, were very, very, very good to me.
Yeah, no, that's good. Well, anyway, Sheffield Wednesday's loss was Bristol City's gain, yeah, because for the first time since you've been at Luton and Brighton, it was sort of coming south of the line, drawn east and west from Birmingham. How did the Bristol City approach come about? Was it John Laycock or Scott Davison who made that initial approach, or did they do it through an intermediary back then? How did that come about?
Yeah, I think it was John Laycock, if I remember. Scott was still there, and John, obviously, with you. They were on the board with Steve and I think four or five other people there at the time.
Yep.
So they just said, would you come down for a chat? And so I said, yeah, no problem at all. So I went down, and it ended up being an interview, which I didn't expect. But it was great, because it just came off, just off the cuff. It was something that wasn't rehearsed and put in, you know, this, that, and the other sort of things in front of them, which I never intended doing anyway. So I was just myself. They asked me lots and lots of different questions. I answered as honestly as I could. And in a couple of days, they asked me if I'd like to join them, which was a fantastic boost, you know, with a club of the size.
What sort of questions do they ask at an interview? Because again, it's 20 years ago when there's no such thing as chief executive. So you're dealing with local businessmen who are good in their own right to varying degrees, but do they talk about, you know, how you deal with players? Do they talk, how would you deal with this based on situations that they've seen? Would you say it was sophisticated, or, you know, quite basic, or, you know, they impressed you, because you have a track record. You've taken a team up to the Premier League. You were just coming up 40 years old. You'd had north of 300 games as a manager, I think, something like that by then anyway. You know, what did they ask you, and what was it that impressed them enough for you to... Because you probably could have got bigger jobs in Bristol City if you'd have maybe waited around, maybe to the autumn.
I don't think that was ever the case, that, you know, waiting around for the big clubs to come along. I think you look at the situation, you look at the clubs that's immediately in front of you, And you analyse whether you'd be happy enough there, whether you could do a job there, whether you could satisfy what their ambitions are. I think all interviews, when you go in, are always very nice, and they're always very complimentary, if you like, to each other and blah, blah, blah. But then, you know, they start to get serious, and there's lots of questions that they do ask. Some that you can't ask, that you can't answer. And you honestly say that, I just don't know, you know, depends on this, that, and the other. There's no guarantees on anything in football, as we know. There's no guarantees in results. You can try and put things in place that will enable you to hopefully get the results that you cherish. So I think from the board of directors at Bristol City at the time, Yeah, there were some tough questions that they did answer. You know, they don't just give you the job just on a whim because they like your eyes or, you know, you smell nice or whatever it may be. I don't know. You know, you go in there and you have to give them some sort of certainty that whatever you do, it'll be everything that you're in your power to do to get success for them. And hopefully that's what happened and that's why I got the job.
I guess the approach from them came out of the blue as job offers or job approaches often do. But once you got the job at the beginning of June. So it's the end of the season, close season, you got a month. I mean, I guess the first thing you do is assess the playing squad that you've got. Yeah. And being in, as they were, League One then, did you know any of the players? Did you have any views on anybody that was there? Or was it a case of waiting until the 1st of July and meeting them all properly in person, knowing them that way?
Well, obviously you've got to know who's going to be available to you when the season comes, and then you've obviously got to look at the retained list that's been put in place by either the former manager or the club themselves, you know, in the absence of a manager. So, you know, you've got to respect as well, you know, the people that's been in there before you as management team. They're not idiots, you know, they know the players. You know, they're not just amateurs who just play around with it. They'll have had to put some hard work and some long hours into their jobs as well. And so the players that they've got that's available to me, you know, there was still a lot of legs left in those, you know. So, but obviously when you do come in, you want one or two of your own players in that you'd like to, emulate the style that you want to play in. And that's what happened. We got to the pre-season. And we knew at the time, you know, we couldn't be going out buying players left, right and centre because they didn't have the money. You know, yep. So there was a lot of emphasis on the youth. And looking at the youth that was coming through at the time, or the lads who were on the fringes at the time, I was quite impressed with them. You know, so I thought, well, you know, there's a good job
to be done. And they said your objective was to get out of the division. They gave you a four-year contract, which is a credible length of time. Did you do any due diligence on them? I mean, the last manager prior to you was Tony Pulis. There was a short period with Tony Forthrop. Tony Pulis prior to that, yeah. Benny Lennartson, but then John Ward, who, you know, got them out of that division and was well respected. Did you give John a call and say what these guys like to deal with, or, you know, other people in the game, you know, to check it out
unless you've got a problem with somebody, I don't think that's what managers generally do anyway. I think, you know, players will react differently to different people, different managers, different characters. How you approach them will possibly get them in a different mindset than they had before, either that be good or bad, whatever. You know, you come in and all of a sudden you've got your arm around somebody who'd be kicked up the arse on a regular basis. You know? So you get a different reaction. And when you start to ask the other managers about that, you're possibly giving a false impression of the player, you know. And so I think that's a little bit dangerous sometimes, because we all have a different way of approaching
people. You're absolutely right. You know, if you ask somebody about somebody, you have to be sure that they don't have an agenda or something like that from that perspective. So anyway, you went there. Did you take Frank with you from day one?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Frank was there, and they said you were able to bring your own assistant from that perspective. Yeah. And then did you sign Lee Peacock that close season? He was signed from Mansfield, wasn't he? Is that right?
Or was he already there? He came from Mansfield. He did, yeah. I mean, Lee was he was very well thought of. He was at Man City when he was a young boy. And he was very well thought of there, but obviously didn't progress in the first team to any certain degree. But we had an idea about him anyway, and Mansfield obviously being in an area where I used to live near Chesterfield, so we'd seen a little bit of him as well, you know. So looking at what we had at the club at that time at Bristol, we thought, you know what, this boy, he needs a challenge. He's ready for a challenge. You know, what a good time to bring somebody of his stature in. And he was a very, very, very strong and willing.
He was energetic and athletic, wasn't he? I always felt that he used to get penalised a lot when he went up for balls, sort of thing. Yeah. Which I guess some players have that about them. If you have a jumping style where your arms create a certain picture, you're always going to be a victim like that, really, aren't you?
Well, he's such a strong boy. I mean, when defenders hit him, they came off him. He looked like they fell the other way. And he could stand his ground quite easy. It was very, very, he was like, he built a granite, you know. So he did suffer the foul rates against him was quite high.
But he's always good for, I'd say he's a 15-goal-a-season guy at that level, which he pretty much delivered. I mean, if you look at that first season, I mean, you had to wait. I've just been looking in the history books. You had to wait until October for your first win. And I actually remember that game. It was a 4-0 game against Reading. And I think you were 4-0 up after half an hour or something. But that game was marred by Danny Rodriguez, one of those horrible injuries where he broke his ankle. And, I mean, he was a very energetic player. I guess you signed him, was he on loan from Southampton, and he was going to be like a foil to play off Lee Peacock? Yeah, was that the rationale?
Danny was a tremendous gifted technical player, quick, pacey, great feet, he could go behind you, loved to play off a big striker, you know, and very bright in what he did. And yeah, that was I remember that game vividly. Yeah, it was such a big blow from the club's point of view, but certainly from Danny's, because he was a great platform for him to go on and do even better, maybe even go back into Southampton's first team, whatever, you know. Yeah, he was a big blow. But
I don't think he ever recovered from that either, did he, from a career perspective?
So, really came
so you finished ninth with 68 points, so you were happy. I guess the board were happy because it was an improvement, and that's obviously a feature of your whole time at Bristol City. Come on to 2001-2002 season. Now, you'd inherited Steve Phillips as a goalkeeper, and I know he played most of the games in 2001, but just checking again in the record books, 2001-2, you split the season between Mike Stowell, who I think is a coach at Leicester now, and Steve. Did you feel you wanted a bit more experience in goal there from that perspective?
Yeah. That was the thoughts of the time, yeah. Mickey was a great lad, but he was a great mentor as well for Steve. Not just
because he was a youngster back then, wasn't he? You know,
And we could see the potential with Steve, no problem at all. But we still thought there's a lot of pressure on him to see a full season through. And what Mike was not only still a good goalkeeper, still capable off the pitch and certainly in training, he was fantastic with Steve. Helped him a great deal. Helped his performances when he did get in the team. Always talking to him, you know. And if I put Steve in instead of Mike, you know, Mike was just put his arm around him and wish him all the best. He was always very, very genuine, and that's why I liked that partnership, if you like.
And I'm just looking at some of the players that played regularly for you that season. I mean, Danny Coles was an emerging talent, wasn't he, at that time? Yeah, he was.
I mean, you can go through quite a few of them. I remember quite a few of the boys that came through the youth. And I've always said, and I still say to this day, and you can see it now in the Premier League, young lads, you know, if you've got the ability, they will be good enough. You know, rather than maybe not to play every week, but give them a chance, because, you know, they will mature into it. They will grow into the positions. And we felt that with the boys anyway. They need the experience around them. They need the help. You know, a team full of young boys is not always going to be successful. But I think putting, you know, a sprinkling of them in the over the season, 3, 4, 5 of them, I don't think it's any harm in that. I think that's what we did with Danny Coles, along with
Joe Brunel was another one that came in.
Joe Brunel, Joe Brunel, Tommy Dock,
and Tommy Dock. Because was it before or after you that Tommy? I think he'd had glandular fever or something. Was that before your time? Because he never got, or was it after you gone? Because he was a great prospect, but after that glandular fever, he never recovered that energy that was a big part of his game, because he was a bit like Jerry Gow. If everybody used to say about Tommy Dock, he's a local, a Bristol boy, but Jerry Gow in his approach. But you had him in there as well. That season as well, 01-02, Tin Man was there. Tony Thorpe, Fox in the Box. Matty Hill, we always used to call him Windmill Hill because he had a habit of giving away penalties and stuff like that. But it was another good season, ninth up to seventh, 73 points, fifth, 5 points off the playoffs, which shows 73. No, that was the year. Sorry, that was a year that I think they cut back in the Premier League, I think. So I think only five teams got up. So because 73 points would pretty much guarantee you in the playoffs. So then we come on to 2002-03 season, and I guess the board were happy with what you were doing because it was progress. you did always play entertaining football, Danny. Everybody would say that, and that's probably reflected what you were like as a player. You'd always been somebody looking to go forward rather than back. One match that stands out from, well, several matches, there's a good handful of matches, 2002-03, 23rd of November, up at Field Mill. I had a season ticket at Villa in those days. Not that I was a Villa fan, but if I had it and used to share it if it didn't clash with City. And I can remember seeing we were 4-2 down, and I was walking up the road, Trinity Road, back to my car. And I kept hearing my phone go off. Well, not here. I could feel the vibration going in my back pocket. And I thought, oh, what's going on there? 5-4 winners after being 4-2 down with 5 minutes to go. I mean, that must be in your, I won't say top five, but your top 10 of matches that you remember. Yeah, tell us about that, what you can recall about that one. Christian Roberts was with you by then as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, Christian Roberts got the winning goal, I believe.
That's right.
Yeah, I think with in that particular moment in time in the team, they were in a great run of form in terms of confidence was sky high with them. And I think from that point of view, they never thought they were going to get beaten. We were 4-2 down, and really, if I can remember the game, we could have been 5 or 6 up in the chances we had and the domination we had in the game. But fair credit to Mansfield, they didn't lay down, they persevered, and we were still very positive. And again, they ended up getting 4-2 in front of us. But we always felt, even on the touchline, we felt this, the game's not over. There's still goals in this game. Because chances, it was end-to-end football, chances were flying everywhere. You know, we were taking a bit more, less caution, you know, than possibly before. And obviously, they were, you know, thinking, well, 4-2 up, we're okay, we can sit back a bit. And we got really very much on top of them. And the 3 goals came within, I think we had a penalty in that. And then the winner came virtually to injury time at Switzerland. And it was fantastic. I remember...
There's another match we'll talk about in a moment in that season, which was certainly being my top five in 50 years. But before we do that, we can't not mention Cup success in the LDV. City's 4th appearance in that competition. 2-0 on the day against Carlisle. A distraction from your league form or a nice distraction? Chance for the players to relax and a piece of silverware for you as well.
Well, it is that as well. And again, you know, how many times will your fans, you know, see you play at Wembley in a competition? You know, I think that's to be considered as well. I mean, it was a great day out for the fans. I think did we take away 35,000 there?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was an amazing turnout. And so it just goes to prove that, you know, what people may perceive as a little small cup in somebody's eyes, you know, when you get 60-odd thousand watching you, there's got to be something there to play for. So, yeah, it was great. It was a great day out. You know, we got a bit of silverware. It wasn't a distraction, in my opinion, because I think whilst you're winning games, you're gaining confidence and you take it into the next game. And you never see anybody saying that the fatigue when you're winning games week in, week out. There's always an excuse when you're losing games. Yeah. It wasn't a distraction.
I think that season you scored in all competitions over 100 goals. And Scott Murray, he got 21 that year, but about 80, again, I just checked, about 18 of those came before Christmas, didn't it? And I think he scored a hat-trick against Mansfield towards the end of that season. You finished third with 82 points, one point behind QPR on 83, although they had a better goal difference. I remember a particular game up at Chesterfield where, you know, if you'd have got a draw, but you lost 2-0, but you had Aaron Brown and Tony Butler sent off. I mean, that one game was the difference between auto and getting in the playoffs, really, wasn't it?
Well, I think... Yes, that, if you look at it clinically, like maybe...
Just look at one... Yeah, there's other games as well.
Over a season, you've dropped a couple of points here and there or whatever, you know. So, but yeah, I mean, you could point to that one with 9 men and losing 2-0 at that stage of the season. Then, you know, you look back and possibly that could have been the reason. But I think overall, you know, the season was terrific. Any other season, getting 82 points, you think you'd be in the automatic positions, you know. But It wasn't to be.
So you got to the playoffs, and then Cardiff away, 0-1. I remember watching the match away at Cardiff on a big screen behind the Atio. And then, considering you've been so prolific in scoring, you must have been confident going and only losing 1-0, confident of turning that round. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, of course. I mean, it's also been a rivalry between Cardiff and Bristol anyway. You know, so it's like a derby game, if you like. So we're always going to be close games. They're not going to be, be home scoring games. Very tough, very competitive, very physical games. But we were always very confident, yeah.
Yeah. So you're coming into 2003, 2004. And I can remember that previous season, Wigan had gone up with a very dour sort of style. They won lots of games, 2-0, 1-0. I think they had a bloke at the back or in midfield, Aaron Dazoo, that was sort of like, seemed to be a bit of a playmaker there. I recall reading, or maybe it was just talking amongst fans, that you looked at what they did that season and you maybe adopted a slightly more conservative approach to playing in 03 and 04, having looked at how Wigan had done it by grinding out results. Is that just me, the foggy memory, thinking what people said, or did you look at it and think, right, this is my fourth year, final year of the contract. Again, you'd shown regular improvement, like a certain other manager that's no longer with us down here. But what were the board saying to you in that close season? I mean, you had to sell Scott Murray, but you did go out and buy Lee Miller and Luke Wiltshire. That 03-04 season in the close season, were they saying, look, Danny, you've got to do it this year, or you, from your own personal point of view, I must do it this year, but I need this player and that player? So when Scott Murray went, was that to fund Miller and Wiltshire, or was that just he wanted to go and play at a higher level?
Well, listen, there's always little caveats to every transfer, and Scott, he wanted to better himself, he wanted to move up a little bit, which is understandable. He'd been a fantastic servant to Bristol City. We weren't in a position to hold him back. So we brought in, like I said, Miller, in particular, just striker, very, very good leader of the line. Excellent in that respect. So I think from that point of view, no, it didn't, and how we wanted to play, we brought, Luke Wiltshire in as well, was a terrifically
good player.
So basically, if you look at the signings that we brought in, we're not buying defenders in there, we're buying more strikers. So our strategy didn't change at all. Our strategy was never going to change, and mine certainly wasn't. The outlook, we wanted to go and score more goals than the opposition. And that's what we've always done. Yes, we'd like to win 4-0 and it's clean sheet, week in, week out. But, if it's 5-4, as we spoke about before, let's do 5-4. Exciting, but we've got 3 points. So we never change our strategy. I think the games dictate when you're playing games. If you're under the pressure a bit, then you end up trying to not to concede. You might be a bit more defensive. If you're coming against a team that's a bit stronger than you, if you're not getting any headway going forward, then you've got to make sure you get something at the game. Well, that's during the game. That's not pre-planned. I think we always pre-planned in every training session was to express ourselves, go out and enjoy ourselves and go and score goals, basically.
How much time do you think, and maybe at lower level, it's different to the higher up you go up the league, which obviously you played there and managed there as well. How much do you look at the opposition and let them dictate how you might line up? Or are you a manager that subscribes to the view, we'll play our own game and be aware of what the opposition do, rather than we need to counter the opposition? What school of thought are you in on that?
I think you'd be stupid to dismiss the ability of the opposition that you're playing against. If you dismiss them completely out of disregard, you're going to get your backside felt. Because the players straight away will come back to you and say, well, we weren't ready for that. We didn't know that would happen. You have to prepare players and give them information. Now, whether they use that information, that's up to them. As long as you've passed the information on, this could happen. If it does happen, this situation develops, this may happen. You're ready for it. You're aware of what's happening and you can counteract it. That's all we gave. We always gave players information, always. Again, when it came to setting the game plan out, that was never about sitting back and letting them, because we thought they had better players than us, letting them dictate the game to us. We always would go against them. But there's certain times in the game when it does turn around and you have to do the defensive side of it. And players have to be prepared to do that and understand what it is and what their role is when we are doing that defensive job.
Yeah. I mean, that season, you had a fantastic period, December into the end of February. 11 straight wins. And when you get on a run like that, you must think, we're going for it this year, yeah? And then the confidence in the camp must have been high during that period, mustn't it?
You know, from whilst I was always there, I never felt at any given time that we were ever under pressure in terms of the season, whether the players were not feeling confident or whatever. That just epitomised it. That was just on, you know, that run that we had there was something that we were very well capable of. You know, very surprising didn't happen before that, and you know, and even season before that. But but we had a terrific run, as you said. Confidence sky high. You know, who knows what's around the corner? We don't know. You know, but if we continue doing the work that we were putting in those 11 games for the rest of the season, there would have been no problem.
I mean, the margins between success and failure are so thin, aren't they? Because if you look at that, I was at that game at Sheffield Wednesday at the upper tier of the Leppings Lane, and we thought, well, you know, we've done enough to earn a point. And then they lob, literally the sort of thing you do in injury time, high ball into the box, yeah. And you lose it 1-0, but it has to come to an end sometime. And for most clubs, it does, unless you're Man City, of course. But I recall another match up at Swindon Town in the April when it was 1-1. I think Christian Roberts had scored. And then Lee Miller, he just couldn't get his head or his leg onto the end of a cross. And that's two matches that, yeah. You know, that's four, what is it? That's 4 points extra.
Yeah.
Yeah. 4 points extra that would have been auto, wouldn't it? Yeah. And, well, you know, but.
It's in a great hindsight, isn't it?
I know. But this time you got to the playoffs for a second successive season. And again, this is where we come on to one of those matches, well, two matches actually that are pivotal. I mean, you got Hartlepool away in the first leg, 1-1, incredible result. And then back at Ashton Gate, full house, losing 1-0. With 2 minutes to go, and you're thinking, oh shit, right? But then the shortest man, one of the shortest men on the field, heads it in. It must have been from a Scotty Murray cross. I mean, if you can remember, I can only remember that because I looked it up in the book. But what are your recollections of that last 2 minutes at Ashton Gate in April 2004, or whatever it was?
Yeah, I have to say, you know, Hartlepool, again, as people perceive certain clubs as being this, that, and the other, a small club, they had a very good side at that time. They, in the both games, they give us a real run for our money. And maybe the other way around, we give them a run for the money as well. But we were perceived as a bigger club, obviously. Hartlepool came in the second leg and played very, very well. They were very, very difficult to break down. And if I remember rightly, they had a couple of good chances themselves to maybe put the tie beyond us coming back. But going back to what I said before, you know, the lads were always had that belief, you know, that they would come back into games. They certainly wouldn't lose games at Ashton Gate anyway. You know, we didn't lose very many games over a period of time. So when the fans, when they started chucking that ball towards the goal, we had a good chance or a good idea that, you know, we would get ourselves back into this game if not going to win it. Yeah. And thankfully we did. And I think, you know, from the atmosphere that was in the stadium at the time was absolutely electric.
I think the referee was Graham Pole, wasn't it? And he said it was an atmosphere that was as electric as anything he'd been at. And he's done Madrid derbies or Rome derbies, that type of thing. As you say, good fella, headed a ball in for the equaliser. And then Christian Roberts, you know, I mean, what a player, you know, on his day. I think Tony Rougier as well, was he involved that year, a lone player?
Tony Rougier was involved, he's a big target.
He became a little bit of a cult hero in his time, but then Christian Roberts burst through, and then the ground just went mental, didn't it, yeah? And well, I always remember, when they look at the pictures of it now, or the video, in fact, before every City game, they show that goal on the highlights of the history of the club. And I always remember Scott Murray kicking one of those little furry microphones as he's giving it to the crowd, you know. But, you know.
I mean, with Christian, going back to Christian Roberts, I mean, he could have been anything, Christian. He had pace and power. He had two very good feet in finishing with, you know, but it was just a little bit erratic. But you can guarantee in games, he would get one or two of those chances in every game that he played in. Now, whether he finished them or not, you know, sometimes was a little bit of a flip of a coin. More than not, he would, but there's odd ones, you know, under pressure, it was scuff wide. But that one on that particular day was fantastic. He made sure he finished with aplomb, and like you said, the place erupted. It was absolutely amazing.
No, that was certainly in my top five in all the time I've been going. But then on to Brighton at the Millennium, as it was, another hot, sunny day. Brighton, I think you'd beaten them 4-1 at the With Dean, I seem to recall, earlier that season, but that was 8 months previous. They had a little player called Leon Knight, who was a thorn in many sides that season. I've got to ask a question. I said this to a couple of people who knew I was interviewing today. I've always wanted to know why no Leroy Lita on the bench that day. 17 years I've waited to ask that question. Leroy didn't feature. And was it that you felt you needed the experience on the day because the guys that were on the bench, I think you're only allowed two subs in those days, if I recall.
Two.
Was it just lack of experience? I mean, do you look back on that day and think, well, as you said, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but why no Leroy that day?
Simply, you've answered the question, was the experience. You know, when you go into big games like that, yes, you can throw a young kid in. You know, there's always that opportunity. As I said to you before, you look back in hindsight and would I have changed it? I possibly wouldn't have changed it because I'm not too sure whether we would have changed anything anyway. You know, because I think from the squad that we had at that time, Leroy was one for the future. He was definitely one for the future. Now, could he have done it for 5 minutes in Wembley? Maybe, possibly. You know, who knows? Well, that's just a decision.
And it was a dodgy penalty as well that they got, wasn't it, really, I think? Because he went past Danny Cole, but he was one of those that would throw himself on the ground, really, wouldn't he?
Oh, yeah, it was. And I think you know, like you say, in any games, there's going to be moments like that. And that moment might have been Leroy's, who knows? You know, Leroy could have just gone in and got tripped up. We just don't know. That's something we'll never, ever know. Would we have won it? We'll never know that either. You know, but what we did, we chose to go with the experience, and unfortunately, we fell short at the end of it, which was a big.
It was a big blow. I seem to recall you saying, as you say, because you'd had year on year improvement. By this time, Steve Lansdowne was chairman, which he still is, well, he's owner now, but de facto chairman. I seem to recall a little radio clip that you said, "Defeat is not failure," which it's not really to some extent, but. Then 5 days after the final, it really was a shock because, you know, you'd have that year-on-year improvement. You know, it was everything heading in the right direction. But 5 years later, you know, 5 days later, I'm putting on the radio and you've gone. Now, your contract had come to an end and a 4-year contract was...
I want to correct you on that. I wasn't on a 4-year contract.
You weren't? That's interesting.
No, I was on a 12-month rolling contract.
Okay, so, that's an interesting point. So 12-month rolling. Right, that's an interesting point because that's being discussed with us. So it's like anybody, you're on 12 months. So, okay, so it was a rolling 12-month. Yeah. How did you leave? Why did you leave? Was it just, look, we need to make a change, I'm the new chairman, you've had a fair crack, we move on, or what? Because it seemed harsh when you look at a certain other manager that had 10 times the amount of resources that any Bristol City manager has had in the past, because, you know, you've seen how much we've spent as a club, we've sold and bought, but there's a lot of money being shelled out. You know, you've done it on a limited budget. How did that departure come around? Was it that just post-game chat that week and they said, look, enough, you know, we're sorry, or, you know, we're paying you off? Just, if you can, what happened there? Because you must have been disappointed, obviously. But, you know, you had a track record that if you'd have been given another crack, everybody would have said, fair enough, maybe this time. So what happened?
Well, I think you've got to look over a period of time of 3 or 4 years, if you like, where not only have we sold players, we brought young players through into the team and been fairly consistent in the results. In doing so, that helps financially the club immensely. Not going out and spending transfer fees is obviously the biggest outgoing of any football club. Wages that go with that, as well as bringing the players in. We hadn't done much of that. And if we did do that, we always made sure that we came out on top on the black side of deals. So I think from that point of view, the financial side of it was being considered all the time. And every time that we wanted or I wanted to bring a player in or whatever, well, you know, we can't afford to be that. Somebody goes out, that's what happened. So we never very rarely went above our budget. Obviously operated below it. Staff as well, of what we had. We had a minimum of staff that were doing more jobs than, if you see the staffs nowadays, that clubs have nowadays, it's unbelievable.
Well, we had seven guys on the bench. I don't mean players, seven support people on the bench now. But then that's not just Bristol City. That's probably most clubs at that level.
We used to have two or three, four people maybe doing 10 people's jobs.
Yeah.
You know, so we weren't flush with staff either. So, you know, everybody was out every night of the week. They were doing all long stints during the day, that type of thing. And then, obviously, we missed out to the final, very, very close. And I had a meeting on the next day, I think it was, a couple of days later, with the chairman, then Steve Lansdowne. Everything was fine. Nothing was mentioned at all. Let's build again for next season. I was more than happy with that, yeah. I went on holiday. I was in my place in abroad with my wife. I got a phone call to say that I was sacked. So that's the news that I got. I had no idea at all of what was going to happen at that time until I got that. There was mootings that they wanted to cut my staff, which was impossible. There was nothing to cut.
There was nothing anywhere. To cut anyway, yeah.
There was nothing to cut. So people were saying that was one of the problems with me. That wasn't a problem at all because there's nothing to cut. We couldn't cut anywhere unless you have a manager who's doing the reserves, the youth team, doing the physiotherapy or whatever. That's the only thing that could have happened. So to say it was a shock to me is an understatement.
It's an understatement. Shock. So it was you'd have that meeting just after the final. Then you went away on holiday as you would do. And then it was when you were on holiday, you got that call. So, and have you, I don't think, so have you been to Ashton Gate since as either a manager or as a guest at all? Or
I've been a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah. So it would have left a nasty taste in the mouth as well, and not without justification, I would say, just as an outsider looking in. But anyway, so that wraps up Bristol City. Looking through the rest of your managerial career, I mean, the Sheffield United, you enjoyed. I mean, people need to look at this. You had 226 games in charge at City. You won 107 of them, or in fact, you didn't lose in 162. That's another way of looking at it. But you had a win rate of 47.3%, which is bloody good. Yeah. And then you went on to MK, Hartlepool, Swindon. And then I guess the period you had at Sheffield, that was pretty successful as well. But going back to a club like Sheffield, when you were a Sheffield Wednesday man through and through, that wasn't without its challenges, I guess. Yeah, but you enjoyed a 52% win there over 100 games. Yeah, so tell us about that spell. Tell us about that spell there.
Well, I think with, first and foremost, yeah, the rivalry between the two City clubs is like Bristol Rovers, Bristol City. You know, it's tremendous. Both are in the same area within a few miles of each other. So it is very, very, very frantic when, you know, when one team's doing well, the other's not doing particularly well, and one enjoys the success and then enjoys the other one's, you know, defeats. But I think when I went there, I was the first one to move as a manager from Sheffield Wednesday to Sheffield United. And a lot of people didn't take to it too kindly. But listen, I've never shared a challenge. I've never.
And they were in League One at the time, weren't they? Yes. And you would have got them to the playoffs in that. In fact, no, auto. You would have got them to auto in that first season. I think you won six games in a row. Then you had the Ched Evans situation to deal with. I mean, as a manager, I mean, you've probably seen in the press, we've signed for eight games. Nigel signed Danny Simpson on loan for the rest of the season. And you could say there's a fair chunk of the supporters that he's getting grief. And he gave a very good reason why he wanted to sign Danny Simpson in his press conference yesterday. But it must have been a disruption losing a guy who'd scored 30 goals for you. That was the difference between success and failure, not on the field, in that one season. It could have made all the difference, couldn't it? Because you lost in the...
With Ched, you know, it was fantastic in the dressing room as well. You know, he had a lot of support in this ongoing situation that was off field with him, from lots of people, supporters included. And when he came onto the pitch, he never bothered him whatsoever. He really concentrated, and he was magnificent for that season. And then losing him as we did, in the manner that we did, it just felt like the plug was pulled out of the balloon. It just deflated so quickly. Everybody just couldn't believe the situation that just happened. It contributed to us not being promoted. That's absolutely no doubt about that. With him in the team, we'd have been up there.
You'd have gone autos, wouldn't you? Because only had to win one of your last three games that year.
Yes.
And if you'd have done that, and you'd have been a hit, you'd have been a hero, basically, even though you were an owl in the eyes of many.
Well, you know, as you say, it's any job that you have in football, results are everything. And the first thing I said to the fans, more than anything, is that results will be everything. Give me a chance to win games. If you win games, you've got a half a chance of turning people around. And it wasn't just winning the games, we were playing some great stuff as well. And I say so myself. Some of the football was horrendous to watch from my point of view. I enjoyed the lads. They were expressing themselves every week, scoring goals for fun. And the fans were turning around, and by the end of that season, they were brilliant with me. And even to the day that I went, they were fantastic. So, you know, for all the problems that possibly could have come from the fact that I went across the other side of the city, it couldn't have been better. It could have ended better. It could have ended better with promotion.
Yeah.
But certainly personally, the people of Sheffield have been extraordinary to me. I've enjoyed my time at both clubs. Yeah.
And then you had a couple of other managerial spells with Barnsley and Chesterfield. But we live in an era now where people want immediate success, or they don't think long term. Full stop. What have you been doing to occupy yourself? I mean, you're still a young man, you know, a very young man. You're younger than I am, but then I'm a very old man. What have you been doing since Chesterfield? What have you been doing through the lockdown? We're not even being able to go to games. Tell us about that.
Well, I think like most people who do try to keep yourself busy. The one of the lovely things that happened in my family is that we've had our first grandchild, and we're in the bubble with his parents as well. So it's been a fantastic time from our point of view. Yes, it's been difficult, you know, but you know we're quite blessed in our area where we're in a lot of countryside, so we can get out and about a bit. But more than anything, it's looking after and seeing my grandson grow up, if you like. I've had when you're running football, it's a 24/7. As I said before, you don't devote enough time to your family because you can't, because the job dictates. So what I did 2 or 3 years ago, I decided that that's enough. I wanted to spend more time with the family. And I just pick and choose what I want to do now. I do my consultancy work, and I do some work with the League Managers Association and with another
All right, yeah.
that we have. So, I'm still fairly busy, you know, but really at my own leisure, which is tremendous.
Do it. I mean, would you be tempted back if somebody tapped on your shoulder? Would you look at a director of football where there's a young coach? Because, I mean, you've had 1,000 games as a manager. There's not too many people that have done that. And, you know, you're 61 this year. You look at people like Sam Allardyce, Roy Houghton. Is it Roy Houghton? Not Roy Houghton. Roy Hodgson.
Roy Hodgson.
The name of
him. Yeah.
He's turning 70 now. Yeah. I mean, would you look at would you look at something like that, or are you enjoying life as it is?
No, I think I would enjoy that, and I'd enjoy it simply because it's like taking, as I spoke to you before about when you see young boys coming through, and you see them developing, you take great pride in they playing the team, and all of a sudden they go on to better things, they play for England or what have you. You know, I've got a couple of situations like that I find very, very satisfying when I see Harry Maguire playing for England now. You know, and you know, bringing through the youth at Sheffield United. So to do that with a manager would be fantastic. Yeah, I would still fancy that. I don't fancy going on the touchline again. I think it's for the young men now. I think they've got,
you know, the director of football with a young coach. You look at that, which doesn't require the 24/7 approach. And your grandson, is he a chip off his granddad's block, or
he's a bit too young yet. We don't know yet. He's only two.
All right, he's that young. And I mean, this season, no fans or what have you, and no, it looks like we'll be going back in August. I mean, there's a couple of things. I'll just fire a few questions at you. Referees, outside of the Premier League, where VAR is a problem by itself, but referees, you don't notice them so much, do you? Have you noticed that with watching games? It don't seem to be so, you know, is it because the crowds aren't on their back that they're able to get on with their decisions?
Well, of course it is. I mean, listen, it's a human mistake game, if you like, where it causes controversy, which is great for the pubs after you get them after the game and something's happened, the referee's not given what you wanted to give. It's a point of conversation, but I think you know, when you've got nobody there and there's no contentious decisions to make and you can't go down the pub and have a chat about it, you know, then there's a lot of pressure taken from referees. Now, can we take that further down? Don't we get better decisions from referees because of that? I don't think that will ever happen. Not even with VAR there, because I think that's contentious in its own way as well.
That was my next question. I mean, VAR, does it have a place? It's just that it's not being used properly at the moment.
Well, I mean, there's so many opinions about it and what's going on at Stockley Park and who's making the decisions. And are they being dictated to by people outside of football and what have you? You know, if you can get people in there who can give a quick decision, who understand the game, who've been in them positions of players, understand what the mindset of the player is at certain situations, situations that players are very, very prone to getting penalties, if you like. If you've got somebody in there that understands all that, you've got a better chance of giving more accurate decisions as you go along. I'm not too sure all along that referees are the answer to be in a Stockley Park. I really don't. I don't think, sometimes yeah. I think that it's looking after your mate. You know, you don't want to put them under too much pressure. You know, asking referees to go and look at a VAR, look at a screen, that virtually says you've got your decision wrong there. You know, go and have a look at it.
Yeah.
And sometimes they don't even change it. The pressure that's on them there now, I think, is a lot more than just a fan shouting down a referee's ear hole. Hey, you shit, you, that was a shit decision. You know, I think there's more pressure on the VAR situation with referees now than there is
than there was before, even with somebody sat up in the box watching it, or the fourth official.
Yeah.
Because in some respects, you think the fourth official, if he was higher up and he was connected, he could have that different view without the constant replays. And are you surprised, because football finance, I mean, if you look at Bristol City this season, right, last year they lost 30 million quid, right, because they didn't, I think the previous year they had the transfer of Webster. They're going to be on course this year for another 30 million pound loss. Okay, they've got Steve the benefactor there in the background now. But are you surprised that they haven't, that there've been no clubs that have gone pop in the last 3 or 4 months? Or do you think that could be on the cards in the next 6 months, that two or three are just going to go pop because there's no money coming in, is there? Premier League, they've got their TV money, but what do you think about that? Yeah. Do you think we'll see a few clubs go to the wall?
The teams outside the top two divisions, and maybe even some in the Championship, you know, they're right on the cusp at the moment. And if they don't get help, or they don't get the fans back in, definitely for next season, You can see that happening in more than one case. You know, I think it's a very, very tough time. And unless you've got a benefactor like Steve, you know, then, you know, your club's going to have major problems. I would suggest that you could go up and down the country, and I would suggest that 90% of the football clubs will be up for sale, if you ask them honestly. Although publicly they've not really said that, but privately I bet you could buy any club you wanted because of the situation they're in, and I don't think they can afford to carry on in the vein that they are at the moment. No business can, never mind football. You know, and so I just think, you know, and unless you are blessed by that knight in shining armour, then you're gonna have problems, and you're gonna have a lot of cutbacks within your football club.
Definitely. Danny, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's been interesting. It's been interesting talking about your non-Bristol City career as well. I found that very interesting, talking about your Bristol City career, which was, you know, onwards and upwards. As I say, I think if you'd have had the amount of financial support back then, even allowing for inflation that has been given to the previous, to Nigel Pearson's predecessor, I think it would have been a different story. One final question I've got to ask for you. I mean, Nigel Pearson, as you know him as a man, I've said on our podcast, and I say you know him as a man, as a teammate and everything, I've said on our podcast, he's the first proper manager we've had, and he hasn't signed permanently yet, he's the first proper manager we've had since you, and I exclude Steve Coppell because he only stayed about 3 weeks or something like that, yeah? Do you think Nigel is the man that can take Bristol City to a division that they haven't been into for 41 years? And is there a little story you could tell us that would make us laugh about Nigel Pearson? Or is he a straight down the middle guy that, you know, he's bigger than you, yeah? That you wouldn't tell us if you knew one anyway. But do you think he's a man who can do it? Is there a little tell you can tell us about big Nigel?
Well, Nigel will give you the best chance as anybody. That's what I'll say. He's very experienced. He's had his experience not just here, but he's been abroad as well. He understands the culture of the English football. I think you, of anybody that's out there at this moment in time, you've possibly got the best fit for Bristol City. Yeah. I think he's strong. He doesn't stand any nonsense. I'll tell you that now. If you're a press man and you want to rile him up a bit, I'd step back 2 yards if I was you, because he won't stand on ceremony. He won't take any nonsense. And that goes for the players.